The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Andrew Nurkin. I'm the Deputy Director for Enrichment and Civic Engagement here at the Free Library, and it's my pleasure to introduce Carolyn Forché tonight. If ours is a moment of witness and resistance, Carolyn Forché has taught us how to speak about what we see happening around us. She's a poet, essayist, memoirist, editor, teacher, translator, and advocate. For 40 years, Carolyn Forché has redefined what it means for poets to write from a place of political engagement, staring squarely at the terror we execute on each other in the name of power, and offering not ideology in response, but a vocabulary of witness to that suffering. Her work remembers what has been done in Hiroshima and Chernobyl, El Salvador and Theresienstadt, and creates a language to hold that deep pain, inviting those of us who would resist to meet together in poetry. Her poetry collections include In the Lateness of the World, Blue Hour, The Angel of History, The Country Between Us, and her first book, Gathering the Tribes, which was selected by Stanley Kunitz for the Yale Series of Younger Poets in 1976. She edited the anthologies Against Forgetting, 20th Century Poetry of Witness, and The Poetry of Witness, The Tradition in English, 1500 to 2001. Which gathered voices of resistance from around the world and across the centuries. If I listed out all her honors, we wouldn't have time to hear from Carolyn herself, so I'll let two recent awards stand in for a legion of others. In 2013, she received the Academy of American Poets Fellowship, given to a single poet each year for distinguished poetic achievement. And in 2017, she won the Wyndham Campbell Prize, given by Yale's Beinecke Library. She's the director of the Lannan Center for Poetics and Social Practice and university professor of English at Georgetown University. Her newest work is a memoir, What You Have Heard Is True, which Claire Massoud calls a riveting and essential account of a young woman's political and human awakening, as beautiful as it is painful to read. Tonight, Carolyn Forché will be in conversation with Beth Kephart, the award-winning author of 24 books, including Going Over, Handling the Truth on Writing a Memoir, and Flow, The Life and Times of Philadelphia's Schuylkill River. Please join me in welcoming Beth Kephart and Carolyn Forché.
Thank you. Thank you. Listen to that applause, Carolyn Forché. We are so happy you are here. I am so happy to be here. This is a very big night for me. I met Carolyn Forché 24 years ago on a single day in a country home outside of Prague, and I'm so happy to be here. I get to ask her questions, and during the asking of questions, Carolyn will be reading, so it's sort of a choreographed conversation. Here we go. What you have heard is true, your poem, the colonel begins, and then continues. I was in his house. His wife carried a tray of coffee and sugar. His daughter filed her nails. His son went out for the night. The poem, a work of art you had for a long time difficulty referring to as a poem, ossified the terrible complexities of the country El Salvador you began to visit in the late 1970s as a 27-year-old American poet and teacher. El Salvador was on the verge of what would become a 12-year civil war. The colonel in that clean house had done many bloody, awful things. You'd been summoned to El Salvador by a man who was a coffee farmer, a political exile, a social critic, an investigator of crimes against humanity, not to mention a collector of miniature ship models. The first night in that country, you slept in an eerily historic place. I'd love for you to tell us about that place, its former tenant, and then read to us from page 66.
Thank you for coming. Leonel Gomez-Vidas, who brought me to El Salvador, had quite a sense of humor. And the first night when I first arrived in the country, not only didn't he pick me up, he sent a Peace Corps volunteer to pick me up, who was late, so I'm standing in Ilopango Airport with no one and not knowing what I'm doing. Finally, later that evening, he takes me to the place where I will sleep that night, and it's the former home of General Martinez, who was the dictator of El Salvador in the 30s, who presided over a massacre in 1932 of tens of thousands of people. And he was a bit of a strange man anyway, but conducted seances in his house and all sorts of strange things. And Leonel said, well, you're going to start your trip by sleeping in the dictator's house. You will sleep in his very bedroom, you know, because the dictator's house had been subsequently purchased by various people, and at that time it was belonging to the sister of a Catholic priest who also lived in the house. So I'm in the dictator's bedroom. It was strange. I seemed to be alone in the dictator's house when I woke that first morning. I saw myself unexpectedly reflected in a mirror as I entered the hallway. But then I heard dishes clattering in a far room and found Blanca downstairs, setting the table for a Salvadoran breakfast of beans with cream, white cheese and tortillas, and if there were eggs, there would be eggs, and also papayas with limes. She came to greet me in a flutter of Spanish, then put her hands on my shoulders, looked into my eyes, and warmly said, "Bienvenida, Carolina, y mil gracias." A thousand thanks? I had only just arrived. For what was I being thanked? We talked simply then in Spanglish, as my conversation skills were still limited and her English had been learned from American television shows. From what I could gather, she was worried about her brother, the priest. Two other priests had already been killed, but I knew that, yes. More than 40 nuns had been deported. She began reciting something that sounded almost like a litany. Aguilares, Padre Grande, Padre Navarro, aquí en San Salvador, y en Aguilares, y campesinos, hundreds, 300s, all dead, even niños dead. She folded and refolded her napkin. Her eyes searched mine and held my gaze. She shook her head, then poured more coffee for us both. Some, whole villages. Leonel will take you. She drew a sharp breath. Blanca, gracias, yes. No, no más café. Gracias, Blanca. When is Leonel coming? Who knows? We never know when he will come. Okay.
A brave woman, Carolyn Forché. So your first job, according to Leonel, was to see. He knew you were a poet. There's a connection that is well described in the book. And one of the great recurring themes, Carolyn, of the book is how long it does take to see and how we can never see everything at once. Time and again, Leonel stops the car in which you are driving, backs up, and asks you, look again. Were we in a class with you right now? And Carolyn, those who have taken class with you talk about the brilliance of your teaching, so pretend we get that moment with you. How would you help us learn to better see?
Well, I've taken my classes on many excursions and walks and things, and I've done with my students what Leonel was doing with me, okay. And I have them write, you know, what exactly they're observing, whether we're in a forest or whether we're in a city or somewhere, so that they can learn to describe the world very, very precisely, and if they come back with just trees and not the kind of trees, or vague statements instead of exact statements. I say, didn't you notice the caterpillar on the ground? You know, and get up close to the caterpillar. Does he look furry? Things like that. We would do things like that. What happened to me was Leonel. He helped me to see in a different way too, which was when I first came to Salvador. I will just give you one little example. The women then were carrying water in urns, on their heads. And these urns were made out of clay then. They weren't plastic urns yet or anything. And they were heavy. They were really heavy. But as they were walking on the roads, carrying water, because they had no potable water near their houses, I would find them very graceful and beautiful. And the urns were beautifully balanced, and they could balance the urns without even touching them, or sometimes just touching lightly with one hand. And they walked like this, and they could move their heads and look around with the urns not spilling a drop. Later, I was on a bus, and a woman came on the bus with an urn, and I offered to hold the urn for her because I was seated and she was standing. She put the urn on my lap. The urn was extremely heavy. And Leonel said, "You have to understand what happens to the human spine from years of carrying something like that on your head." So he explained what happened to the human spine. And I never looked at the women on the roadsides again as merely graceful and beautiful.
Thank you. When you returned to America and published your poems, it was imperative that those poems be seen, for it was your hope that your words of witness would change minds and even perhaps American policies. How do you balance your position as a seer with your responsibilities as an activist? And how do you maintain that balance today when the world, more than ever, needs to be reminded of the plight of those who leave their homelands for what has become, in some terrible ways, a hostile northern border?
That's a big question. When Leonel invited me, he came to invite me to El Salvador because I was a poet. And he thought, because he was Salvadoran, that poets were very important, and that poets were important to their own cultures and their own people. And he also believed that poets saw the world a little differently, a little askew, a little strangely, and that would be helpful, and that poets may not have the same presumption of objectivity that journalists have. So he wanted to bring a poet and show this poet everything, because he believed that when the war came, that poet could come back to the United States and explain everything to the American people. So I tried to help him to understand how the American people tend to view poets, if they view them at all. And I went through the usual litany of how poets wind up in this country, and you know, how we're basically a fringe element. And so he looked at me in a puzzled way, and he said, "Really? Well, you'll just have to change that." And I began to think he was a little bit out of his mind at that point. But so he wanted to educate a poet. He wanted to show me everything. He didn't want to tell me what to think or what to believe. And he also was studying me because he wanted to see how Americans would think and how an American person would react to the situation there. And so all he asked of me was that someday I write and talk. He didn't tell me what to write and talk, but I must write and talk. And when I came back to the United States, I didn't see how this would be possible. And it was because I was just a poet. But it was a poetry book that allowed me to go and speak to Americans during those war years. And it was the poetry that led me to those opportunities. And so, and led me to be viewed as a political poet, which is not, it's a pejorative term for a lot of the literary world. So I had to come to terms with what it meant to be considered political, and that I was now considered that way. In terms of activism, that all evolved slowly over time. I realized I had become an activist because the talks and the poetry readings and all of that activity was focused toward helping to build a network of anti-intervention sanctuary and opposition to U.S. support for the Salvadoran dictatorship. So that all started to evolve slowly. It wasn't something I chose. It wasn't something I was even aware was happening in the beginning.
Yeah. And we were talking back there how you've been writing this book for 15 years and how absolutely profoundly relevant and necessary it is right now, not just as a historical record, but as a reminder of what is being left. In a recent interview, you were talking about that.
I was writing this for 15 years. It was really difficult. Yeah. And for a long time, I thought, well, this is an old story, and no one will be interested anymore. And slowly, the violence escalated in Central America, in all the countries, and made necessary the swift departures of many people. People don't leave their countries and pack up nothing, on just what's on their backs, and lift their children into their arms and run away from their houses, from the places where their ancestors are buried, from their communities, from everything they know. They don't do that unless they have to. They don't go through danger unless the danger they're running from is more frightening to them than anything they can anticipate happening. So I realized that maybe the book would be helpful for people to understand this situation in this particular country, El Salvador, from the beginning. And it's before the war. It's what caused the war. So what happened to cause the war? So I'm hoping also that the Salvadoran refugee students that I've taught, some of them DACA, some of them not, who've come over the years to ask me to talk about their countries, will be able now to read it, because they've told me for years, my parents won't talk to me. They won't tell me about their lives. They won't tell me about Salvador. They won't tell me what happened to them. So they come into my office and sit down and say, please tell me what happened. So this might make that possible.
It will. Lionel, he talks. He instructs. One might even say he lectures, Carolyn, and you listen. He infiltrates each scene or understanding with new information so that beside beauty or beneath it, danger always lurks, and of course, vice versa. Nothing is stable, nothing is fixed, and you capture that exquisite imbalance all throughout the book. I've asked if you might read from page 78.
Thank you. Yes. The highlands were fog-wrapped from a distance, and as it was January, the coffee harvest was still in progress, although coming to an end. Harvesters were among the coffee trees, pulling the last of the coffee cherries into the canastas tied to their waists. When these canastas were filled, these cherries were poured into a sack that the harvester dragged behind her. And when the sack was full, the coffee would be weighed and the harvester paid so many centavos for each tarea of coffee. Almost nothing, Lionel explained, downshifting around a curve, filling the silence that still hung between us. It has always been almost nothing. Nothing and a tortilla, maybe. And you know, it wouldn't have gone as well if you had known any more than you did, referring to our visit with Medrano. And then he asked if I knew when coffee consumption had begun. And for a moment, I saw the Lionel who had visited me in California. Without waiting for an answer, he shouted over the engine, "In the 15th century in Sufi shrines of Yemen." No, I didn't know that. Well, then there might be other things you don't know, such as when those sons of bitches interrogate someone, they tie the man to a chair, put his hand on a table, cut off one of his fingers, and they flush it down the toilet before asking the first question. He glanced at me, barely taking his eyes from the road. I tried not to react. "And our Colonel Chacon has a friend he works with. And this friend claims to be a doctor, but I don't know. The doctor injects the spine of a victim with anesthetic. Then he slices through the person's abdomen with a scalpel, reaches in, and starts pulling out guts while the person is conscious and can see what is happening. And then the colonel gets to the first question.
Yeah. Grace Paley encouraged you to write your memoir, and you were saying back there when we were looking at photographs that Yale Doctorow, many have, wanted you to write this book. But what did Grace tell you about what memoir is and what it would require of you?
Grace, we were walking on a beach in Provincetown, and one day, and I was not very long out of Salvador, and she said, I said I might want to write prose about this someday. And she said, well, I'm going to tell you the secret of great writing. Grace Paley is going to tell me the secret. So I said, I didn't want to push her or anything. I said, okay. And she said, you just write and write and write, and then you take out all the lies. And then she said, it's not as easy as it might sound. So that was one thing that actually verbatim, she said to me, it was verbatim because I wrote it down. But she was also very encouraging, and she did want me to be clear about those times when I was working as an advocate and an activist, and those times when I was sitting to write. And because she didn't want me to write with the intention with which I would pursue activism or advocacy, she didn't want me to lose the access to my unconscious, to memory, and she wanted me to have that receptivity that one has to have to produce something good, to write well. So she said, you can't think of all those things when you're writing. You think of all those things when you're talking to people. Yeah.
Two brilliant women talking to each other. You subvert the conventions of the past tense in this book, giving it the urgency of present tense, the suspense, and deliberately avoiding commentary so that the moments in and of themselves speak for themselves. I want you to talk about your tense choice as you built the book, and I want to point out that to our audience, the opening pages do begin in present tense. They begin with, it is near the end now, which is so mystical and mythological, and then within two pages you move to, over the years I have asked myself, and you remain then for the next several hundred pages, all of them, in past tense, but without the sort of commentary that past tense typically registers on the page. I would love for you to talk about this.
This was such an interesting experience because I read a wonderful book by Sven Burkhardt, Time and the Art of Memory and Memoir, and he was talking about this now-then rhythm that most memoirs have. You know, this is what happened, this is what I think about it now, this is what happened, this is what else I think about it now. And so I thought you had to do that. You know, I probably didn't read him carefully enough, but when I started writing this, I would try sometimes to break the action. What I was trying to do was write my way through what I went through again so that someone else could go through it with me. And and every once in a while I would remember that you're supposed to say how you feel now, you know, but whenever I tried to do that, it would just break the story. It would interrupt. It would take me out. It would take the reader out. So I cut out. I didn't allow myself to do those things, and I cut them out as much as I could. And finally, I eliminated them altogether. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. So there's very, very little speculation, you know, from my own present self. And most of it is in past tense, but there are passages where it becomes very intense. And you know, the mind changes when you're in a situation of extremity and fear and revulsion. And in those moments, I began writing in present tense because I couldn't write them without reliving them. Mm-hmm. And that reliving them made them present tense again. Mm-hmm. And so also I could then distinguish those states of mind from the narrator who seems to be doing fine. So that's why the language starts to get stranger and stranger as you go through the book.
That is a wonderful answer to that question, and I'd love to talk to you for 10 hours about it all, because I experienced those moments as sort of dream states still held within the past tense. So you achieved what you sent out to achieve.
Thank you.
You were, you believe, the last to record a conversation with the fourth Archbishop of San Salvador, Orozco Romero, 1 week before he was murdered. You were raised as a Catholic in Catholic schools, and so your connection to this man was profound on many levels. I'd love for you to read about that moment in time when you first encounter him on page 193.
This is how I first saw Monsignor Oscar Romero, from a distance, over the heads of the congregation, in an unfinished cathedral, in his white vestments, before a spray of microphones, giving a homily, ending with a litany of the names of those disappeared or found dead that week, some of whom were in coffins lined up at the altar with windows cut into the lids to reveal their faces, except the mutilated. In shafts of sunlit dust sent from the louvers of the two bell towers, we stood shoulder to shoulder, women in scarves or mantillas, men holding their straw hats, children sitting along the altar rail as the homily was broadcast to thousands of radios throughout the country, to machine shops, bodegas, to pickup trucks, and the battery-operated radios in the villages. When his homily, giving guidance and counsel, came to an end, Monsignor walked toward the coffins with an aspergillum, sprinkling holy water on the dead. And then he walked through the congregation, and we parted to make a path for him, the water sprinkling down on our bowed heads as it had on the coffins. Later, I would understand that here, the dead and the living were together, and those who stood alive before him, he was blessing in advance.
A question that occurs to me as I listen to you read that so beautifully. You discovered the passion of your life in El Salvador. Of course, you've traveled many other places. You've borne witness to many other things. But you also discovered the love of your life, the man you married and are married to still, and with whom you've raised your son. And maybe you could just talk a little bit about who he is and your intersection, because Romero is sort of part of that.
There's an episode in the book where I received a phone call, and could I please come to the seminary in the capital, because several hundred campesinos had taken refuge there, running away from the military, and they had been wounded, some of them. And Monsignor decided to create an ad hoc refugee camp there and allow them in, hoping and trusting that sanctuary would be respected. But really, they were afraid it might not be. So what they wanted was for me to be a Western journalist and to go there and stand very visibly in front of the people and be writing and taking notes and taking pictures and so on. And unbeknownst to me, someone else had received a similar phone call and also showed up to be a Western journalist. And that day, we regarded each other a bit warily, this other Western journalist and I. And he thought I was a Catholic nun, and I thought he worked for the CIA. So we weren't that interested in each other. But we went through the whole thing of the army arriving in the trucks, and it was really horrifying. And we stood out in front of that seminary taking notes and taking pictures, and miraculously, the army then began to leave in their trucks. So I didn't see him again for several years, and we met again when I was asked to write the text for a book of photographs about El Salvador, and we didn't recognize each other from the seminary day. And at one point, you know, this is in the book of how we discovered that we were, in fact, the nun and the CIA agent. So that was Harry. And Harry was a photographer and still is. And so was it very, he had gone all the way through the uprising against Somoza in Nicaragua and then came to Salvador. So he had a great deal of experience in Central America.
And you write in the book that you learned of his experience through his photographs, and he learned of yours through your poems and the way that you spoke to each other. And those intense 2 weeks when you were writing the introduction to that book, it was almost like a Patti Smith, Robert Mapplethorpe moment, you know.
There are funny bits in this. It's not all horrifying, and yeah,
okay. It's all good. I have two more questions. This book, as you said, took 15 years to write, and it arrived 16 years after the launch of your last book, that gorgeous poetry collection, The Blue Hour. And much of the material appears to be recovered from the journals you kept in El Salvador, lines and scenes set down in faint pencil. In fact, there are artifacts of that in the book, in addition to some of Harry's photographs. I wondered whether returning to those journals was a peaceful experience where you sort of re-inhabit the person you were, or was it an episode of overwhelm?
It was very difficult to write this, and it took me a long time to write the last 50 or so pages. Mm. That was the worst. And I discarded three other versions of this book before I finally found my way in to telling this story again. And I think you can't tell it without reliving it, and reliving some of it was very difficult. And I was hoping to, I had other urgent problems, which I wanted to protect people, I wanted to protect certain people's identities. But as time went on, that became less a problem. Some of them died, others of them no longer worried about protecting their identities. And so it became both easier and more difficult as I went along. I won't say this was easy, the writing of this, I can't say that. And books do take a long time, for those of you who are taking a long time writing your book.
We have all been absolved. So the last question then, where I'm going to ask Carolyn to read. When I was reading this book, my husband is Salvadoran, and I've been to the country a few times, and I just couldn't stop talking about it. I couldn't stop reading it out loud to my husband, and I often could not stop crying. And this, what I'm going to ask you to read, I don't think I'll be able to listen to it without crying, but I'm going to ask. The book ends with your return to El Salvador to distribute the ashes of Leonel, to whom you have dedicated this book. And I would love to close this part of our conversation with your honoring of him.
First, I want to thank you. This has been wonderful.
Well, thank you.
From the peak of the volcano, city and sea are visible, and the whole of the country as it shrinks to its place on the maps, small and poor beneath us. A country that had for a time grown large under the gaze of the world. Before the war, tapirs lived in the mountain's folds, monkeys and iguanas, coyotes and even jaguars, the wildcat of his prescient dreams. Hundreds of species of birds alighted here, 1,000 of butterflies, and the streams ran clear through Wazapa's ridges to the river. No longer. Thousands of pounds of bombs rained into this forest during the war. White phosphorus and napalm also rained. So that might have been the reason he brought me here just before the war began, and why he was silent all afternoon more than 35 years ago. He had said that he wanted to show me a beautiful place, to take a rest from the work we were doing, to climb, to see as far as we could. But I now know that we were here for a different reason. Here, so that he could steady the far hills in his field glasses and read the terrain of a future free fire zone. Here to commit the mountain to paper and then to say goodbye. I still have the paper on which he drew the mountain. Awachapan prison too remains with me. When I hear the word Awachapan, there is a wind rising out of a smoking village and processions of campesinos on the roadside. My husband is holding Olivier in his arms, and along the banks of the Rio Sumpul, vultures rise and fall over the dead, and so thick is this flock that the banks seem to be rippling like the river. Awachapan gives me the last time I saw the labor leader Jose Rodolfo Vieira alive, and he is waving to me from the back of a truck before it rolls into a white cloud of road toward his future assassin. Margarita and I are walking along the beach, trying to find the corpse of a missing Danish woman, and we don't find her, but someone else does. She had been shot through the forehead after watching her young husband be tortured to death. I can show you their photographs and give the details. There are reports on everything. Awachapan. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. We.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for that. We have time for questions, and we wait for the mic because this is podcasted and shared with others at, through the generosity of the library. Mm-hmm. And so I am happy to call on people for Carolyn to answer. And please do remember to phrase your question as a question.
Thank you both for coming and for your inspiring readings and your inspiring interviewing. So I would like to know what happened, where you met on that day, 24 years ago outside of Prague.
Well, should I answer that?
Yes.
I would remember that, she would not.
I do remember, vividly.
I was there as I was learning to write. I was there as part of a workshop, and I was very generously invited by Jane Ann Phillips to join the faculty of this Prague group in a countryside, and my husband and son were there with me. And there tomorrow I will have a piece in Lit Hub about that moment, that time with Carolyn. And there's a photograph of me just leaning forward, wanting everything I can get of her essence and soul. And so it meant a lot to me, and it means a lot to me tonight, 24 years later, to be here with Carolyn Forché.
Thank you.
I have just started reading the book, but I have a question about Anna. Are you like her?
I think so, in a lot of ways, I am, yeah.
And does that get explained throughout the book?
I come back to Anna a few times, yeah. You'll get to know her.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
There are 400 pages or so in this book.
Anna is my paternal grandmother. She was from former Czechoslovakia.
Yeah.
And so she makes an appearance. She was a strong influence in my life when I was a child.
I'm glad you're here, Carolyn.
Thank you.
Well, for those of us who have taken or are taking a while to finish a book, I'm interested in what you learned, what wasn't working about the other three versions, and sort of how you got from A to D.
Well, the other three versions were the kitchen sink school of memoir. In other words, I was trying to write about too many parts of my life. Uh-huh. I did not understand the distinction between autobiography and memoir, and I had to focus. And I realized that the story I most needed to tell was this one. And so I had to take everything else out, and I had to be able to recognize what was extraneous to this. So I actually have other stories from my life in the cast-off memoirs.
When will the next one come out?
15 years from now.
I'll be here, Carolyn. I'll be here.
I'll be dead when the next one comes out. Wait. Hello.
Lamont Steptoe here.
Lamont, it's wonderful to see you.
Likewise. I was going to ask you about your process. For example, when I write poems, all my poems are written in cursive. I never use a machine to write my to write poetry. But when I work on things like a memoir, then I will sit down at a computer and type in the prose. What is your process?
I have a lot of notebooks, all of them in cursive. And someday, you know, no one's going to be able to read cursive, so they'll have to hire a specialist to decipher our English cursive. But I found with prose it's helpful to use the keys. And so I am the same as you. I was writing in the computer. As a result, there's all kinds of versions of my book in the computer. They say final version, final version, super final version. I mean it this time, it's final. So instead of numbering, I just have these strange labels. Yeah.
What was the last version called?
You mean the title actually, or the last? Super final, I mean it this time, it's 2018. That would have been it. Yeah.
I think that being able to live with pain is quite difficult. And I kind of think it's a problem we have in American culture. My view would be that the Germans, some, have learned to live with a horror and thereby begin to redefine their culture. When I, if you've seen the film If Beale Street Could Talk?
Not yet, but I very much watched it.
It's also sort of living with pain, but somehow in your book and your experience, that's so strong. And I just would like you to talk about what sort of transformation that brings about. And I was wondering if your students at Georgetown are open to pain, but know where to take it?
Those are a couple of different questions. I think we in our culture must learn to bear pain and to integrate it into our lives and not to turn away from it or deny it. We have denied a great deal of our history, and that's bearing fruit now, and we have to turn around and look very clearly back all the way to the beginning and understand what we've done for generations, including now. And I think that this fear of looking at things as they are and of understanding the horrors of the past has also crippled us in terms of being able to cope with pain. I feel that there's a great deal of pain in this country, and I don't think we know yet what to do with it. My students, this new generation, they're wonderful. They're very engaged. They're very concerned about especially planetary degradation and climate collapse, but they're willing to do something about it, and they're very open, and they're not afraid. And the present students, the ones that are in high school now and junior high school and college, undergrad, are different than other students I've taught over the years. They know that they're in trouble. They know they were born into a world that will require more of them than it has required of any previous generation. So, yes, my students are open, and those that are very much open and fully capable of commitment and the work that needs to be done. So that gives me hope. It's not the hope of fools, as I point out when I quote Manlio Arquette at the beginning of the book. It's the hope of having clear awareness of what kind of situation you're in. When you have that, you can have hope. and it's a kind of clarity of spirit.
I'm curious about, there are many poets when confronted with atrocity in war go into silence and publication silence, right? I think of Oppen and Kaufman as two individuals that did that. You seem to have done, I don't want to put impose a relationship on it, but the opposite, and came into a commitment to the publication of poetry and witness. And I was curious if you could talk about that commitment to publication and that commitment to poetry in times of atrocity.
I was committed to gathering the poets of the 20th century and now the 21st century who endured conditions of extremity and wrote out of those conditions. But I am not a prolific poet. It will be 17 years between my most recent book and the one that's going to be published next year. I didn't realize it was that much time, but it used to be that I would write a book every decade of poetry, of my own work. But it's true that I've been very committed to trying to learn a new way of reading the works of poets who have experienced extremity. And that's what I mean by a poetry of witness. So that opening that space between the intimacies of the hearth and the institutions of the state, opening that social space and allowing where writing takes place, public debates, that's the space for the press, it's the space for all of our conversations, national and local, and that space is something that I believe has to be enlarged and made much more vital and vibrant. And not for no reason is it being closed down and narrowed now. Not for no reason is the press being attacked, and that space, which is also has to do with universities and education, being compressed. It allows tyranny to thrive. So, yeah, I'm committed, but I'm not very prolific. And I don't know why that is.
Maybe because every poem is so brilliant, it takes some time.
Well, Beth kind of just said what I was going to say, which is my theory is that you're not very prolific because every word is so perfect.
Thank you.
I just keep hearing, as you are reading, the lyricism and the rhythm and the gorgeousness. And that's something that I've always admired in your poetry, that a poem could be so painful and also so beautifully rendered. So thank you for that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for coming, Carolyn. I'm curious, returning to artifacts, journals, photographs that were taken so long ago and writing the same piece over 15 years, when you did return to those, how the meaning of them changed for you, how you perhaps saw yourself differently through them, and through your process over 15 years, how you sort of allowed your writing and your thinking and reliving these moments, how you allowed them to breathe and to change and develop and give yourself that space through such an extended period of writing.
Anyone who's kept diaries and journals or correspondence, we used to write letters and post them, and then people would write to us, and we would save those. Anyone who goes back through their life reading that kind of material can't help sometimes being amused or chagrined or embarrassed by one's earlier self, and I certainly was by aspects of my earlier self. I was a bit of a pill sometimes in this book. I fought back. And I think something magical happened while I was writing this. As soon as I knew it was the El Salvador story, things started to magically arrive in my, people would send me something. Oh, you wrote these letters to me years ago about El Salvador. I'm sending them back to you. Mm-hmm. There was a box of correspondence between Terence Dupré, mm-hmm, and me, and this correspondence was in some kind of storage facility for decades, and suddenly arrives just at the moment that I needed it. Wow. So I was really curious about those kinds of strange moments when I seemed to be getting some help from somewhere that I couldn't explain. So finding things, unearthing them, going through them again, you know, and being embarrassed by them, but also thanking my past self for writing them down, you know, because suddenly I have a scene that really wasn't stored in my memory, but it's there in the notebook. Thank you, young Carolyn, for writing that down. That's
I'll preface my question by a quick comment. I lived in El Salvador for 4 years, 70 to 74. I returned in 1983. I was doing Peace Corps health, public health work there. And I returned in 1983 to examine emergency room facilities and their capabilities to deal with mine injuries, mostly lost extremities. So my question, and I might also say I only recently began to rethink and to look over records that I kept. Mm-hmm. And it was terribly emotional. So how do you deal with the anger is the question. The despair about that kind of situation, about the very world we live in.
I was very angry at my own government for a long time, and that really, for some reason, hasn't gone away. But maybe I focused it on my own government rather than on anything else. Because my government was making possible all of that atrocity. And you were there in an interesting time. You were there before I was there and after I was there. And someday I'd love to know what especially was going on in the earlier 70s period when, you know, we had all of that electoral fraud and everything that was going on then that you're very aware of. And I was in a state of shock. I had some years that I'm sure were not, I think I was affected by a lot of this, a lot of what I saw. And I was a little bit numb, other than being obsessively dedicated to countering the US State Department line and the American policy. You know, that's where I put it all. I put it all there. And then I slowly had to come out of that fog, that terrible, I think it was grief, you know, of what I saw. And I know what you're talking about with the ERs in Salvador, because there were a lot of people after I went back after the war, many, many people had lost limbs. One particular young man lost both of his arms and his eyes. It was terrible, and he was so young, you know, a kid, and was living the rest of his life that way. So, it, you know, thank you for doing that ER work. I don't know whether I've answered your question, because I'm not sure it has an answer on the deep enough level that, you know, would be helpful.
Because a younger generation may not be as familiar with Terence Desprez and his work, could you say a few words about him for us?
Yes, I'd be happy to do that. Terence Desprez was one of my closest friends, and he wrote a book called The Survivor, An Anatomy of Life in the Death Camps, and it was a study of people who had survived the camps during the Shoah, but also in the Soviet Union, in the Gulag, and he particularly was also interested in people who wrote. So there, he studied Elie Wiesel, for instance, and also Anna Akhmatova and others who bore witness to extremity during the 20th century, particularly during those genocidal events and horrific events. And the book is beautiful. I recommend it very highly. It's eloquent, and it found a way to somehow find humanity in those contexts. and preserve humanity in those contexts. And so it's called The Survivor. Terence Dupre is two words, Dupre, D-E-S-P-R-E-S. So I really recommend it. It was published by Oxford University Press in 1976. Terence died in 1987.
There's that gorgeous crushed shared raspberry in The Survivor that just is for me the shining image of that book. We, Carolyn and I, thank everybody who's come. We thank the library and Andy and Andrew for hosting us. And there are books. I've already got two of mine signed, so you guys go get yours signed.
I will sign as long as you're here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.